morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. If I were to try and summarize our position with respect to the first argument in 30 words or less, it would be that this court's decision in Brown was correctly decided, that the 2003 decision in Trout was not correctly decided, and the evidence of that is in the Supreme Court's analysis in Austria versus Altman. And looking back at the Brown decision, Brown was asking for a retroactive application of Section 114(2) of the Civil Rights Act of 1991. And the court held that if Brown were not asking for a retroactive application, that the court should apply the law in effect at the time. And the rule of strict construction comes up only because Brown was asking for a retroactive application. Retroactive application was barred by the sovereign immunity under the law of the circuit, under the Jordan case under Nichols. And the threshold question in this appeal is whether or not the application of Section 114(2) is retroactive, and that turns upon what is the relevant conduct. And that's the first question that the court has to address. And we submit that Altman corrects the error in the 2003 opinion that says that completed conduct is the appropriate test. Under Altman, the triggering event is the assertion of sovereign immunity defense to the payment of prejudgment interest, and the status of the litigation is what determines whether or not the application of Section 114(2) is actually retroactive. So what we're asking for in this case, Your Honors, is the prospective application to a case that is clearly within the scope of the waiver of sovereign immunity contained in Section 114(2). Altman follows from Landsgraf. Both cases, of course, were written by Justice Stevens, but there's a gloss, and the majority in Altman picks up and refers to Justice Scalia's opinion in Landgraf, and that's in footnote 17 of the majority's decision in Altman, and it's picking up the view that was expressed by Justice Scalia that the key is what is the relevant conduct that is triggers or determines whether or not the statute is actually going to apply. We submit that there's support for this approach also in the decisions from the Federal Circuit, because the Federal Circuit first asked the question whether or not the retroactive application is what the parties are looking for or talking about. And looking at the dissent at Altman is interesting and I think informative, because the dissent in Altman looks to INS versus St. Cyr and Martin versus Haddix to provide the rule of decision, but the majority in Austria versus Altman doesn't cite or quote or rely on either of those cases. And instead of focusing on reliance interests, the focus of the majority is on what is the triggering or determinative event. And the dissent asserts that the majority, and perhaps it's fair to say the dissent is complaining that the majority is adopting a different analysis because the rights at issue are not private rights. And the majority, in fact, says that Landgraf's default rule, and it is a default rule against retroactivity, is most helpful in cases involving private parties. Certainly the majority in Austria versus Altman rejected the idea that the Austrian government has a reliance interest in retaining the artwork that the Nazis stole some 50 years earlier, and it certainly suggests that the federal government in this case has no similar reliance interest in maintaining its discriminatory policy. But in any event, in Austria versus Altman, the majority rejected the notion that fairness to individuals or to foreign states was the key to deciding that case. And what the majority looked to is whether or not what the triggering event was, and it's our contention that there can be no assertion of sovereign immunity to the payment of prejudgment interest until such time as judgment is actually entered. Final judgment was not entered until 2003, a little more than 2 years after the passage of the Act, and that is in fact the triggering event. And that the analysis of sovereign immunity or defense of sovereign immunity that the Supreme Court applied to the Austrian government should also apply to the United States government in this case. Moving on to the second issue, the question of the prevailing parties, I think we...
Excuse me a second. Just repeat the last statement about Austria and the United States.
Well, that the analysis of an assertion of sovereign immunity raised by the Austrian government, that analysis ought to apply to an assertion of sovereign immunity by the United States government, because what the majority opinion is saying in Austria versus Altman is that the triggering event, the key event, is when that immunity is actually asserted.
It tied that to some extent to the context of relations among states, saying that, to give an example, not necessarily in the opinion, if a former adversary becomes a non-adversarial or an ally, and the government extends to it an immunity, or vice versa, removes an immunity as the relationship deteriorates, it makes no sense for the Congress to intend that the courts continue to adjudicate claims in its favor or grant immunity in its favor on matters arising during the prior relationship, before the change.
Yes, and that certainly...
How does that play out here?
That would certainly be something that the Congress could do by amending a statute.
And then in Fernandez, the Supreme Court says the analysis in Altman was special to the FSIA.
But what the analysis in Altman also did is took Mr. Justice Scalia's concurrence in Landgraf and Rivers and said in the footnote 17 that, well, Landgraf may provide the default rule, but since we're looking at waivers of sovereign immunity, we ought to look at the question of what's the purpose of the waiver and how the purpose of the waiver ties into the statutory
language.
Again, though,
they said for purposes of the FSIA. Right, that they were doing that uniquely for the FSIA.
Certainly the court was interpreting the FSIA and certainly the language in a later case.
And you rely on three cases, principally one from the Sixth Circuit, that follow very closely the line of argument that you're addressing, but they all precede Fernandez.
I think the Sixth Circuit case came out a couple weeks after Fernandez, but certainly there's no indication that either the majority of the dissent considered the holding in Fernandez. But what we're looking at is a decision from the Supreme Court and saying, well, are there any glosses or any modifications that are appropriate in looking at or applying the Landgraf default rule, and certainly in the context of sovereign immunity, and certainly within the specific context of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, that the court said we got to look at whatever the triggering event was.
So let me just restate this then, see if this is accurate. The general rule, the default rule, pardon me, coming out of the majority opinion in Landgraf, is that is against retroactivity. That nothing is to be construed as being retroactively applicable unless it clearly states that it is. But in a case where the Congress alters the immunity of other states, the court decides that has to be applied henceforth to all cases, regardless when the originating or primary conduct occurred.
Now, I think what the court was saying in Altman was that the triggering event, and this goes back to the court picking up Justice Scalia's concurrence, it says for determining whether or not there's a waiver of sovereign immunity, that the question is
of other sovereigns in that context.
Of other sovereigns,
right.
But whether or not there's a waiver of sovereign immunity, that what we look to is what's the triggering event, and so to go back to your opinion in Brown, the question is what is the triggering event for determining whether or not the application of a specific statute is retroactive, and is. I read your Honor's opinion, you're saying that the people in Brown were clearly looking for a retroactive application, and our argument is that no, we're not asking in the Trout case for a retroactive application of Section 114.2 of the 91 Act. We're saying that the triggering event occurred in 1993 when final judgment was entered in this case. And so we're looking at Austria versus Altman to say that the triggering event for this particular assertion of sovereign immunity did not take place until 2 years after the statute had passed, and therefore its application to the Trout litigation is not retroactive as that term is defined and understood in Landgraf right through the line of cases up to Austria versus Altman. With respect to the question of a prevailing party, I think the perhaps it's fair to say that there's agreement as to what the key case is. We believe the key case is Morgan, and Morgan says that fees spent for time spent on claims that were ultimately unsuccessful could be excluded only when the claims are, quote, distinctly different in all respects, both factual and legal, from the plaintiff's successful claims. And that's Morgan citing Hensley. And we would submit that since the case came back from the Supreme Court in 1986 on remand, the next decade or so of litigation, 2 decades of litigation, focused solely on the question of what sort of relief should be given to members of the plaintiff class. The relief that was ultimately awarded turned upon the plaintiff's regression analysis, the plaintiff's, and ultimately the defendants agreed to pay 100% of what the plaintiff's expert showed, but it was a difference in compensation using the regressions, holding education and experience as constant, and saying, well, in this year,
seems that if you're here involved with the question of interest on a particular part of the recovery in light of sovereign immunity, is it?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Now, isn't that an independent question from the merits question?
It's our contention that it is not, Your Honor, that it is a question of the – there was only one claim, one cause of action here, and the cases talk about claims or causes of action. At the end, there was one claim, and that was the discrimination.
Your claim had been utterly frivolous. Not your merits claim had been perfectly good, but your claim for interest were utterly frivolous. Would you still say you were entitled to attorney fees on it because it arose out of the same criminal nexus?
Our argument, I'd submit, is a little more nuanced than that. Our claim is that we
I'm
could,
trying to get you to answer my question.
Okay.
I understand your argument. The answer is,
even though
as long as it arose out of the same original claim, you would say you're entitled to counsel fees.
No, Your Honor.
If it were fees on the original claim.
No, Your Honor. Our argument is that we would still be prevailing parties, and
right.
whether or not we would be entitled to fees for that frivolous
so you
claim.
You subdivide the status of prevailing party.
That's correct, Your Honor, but certainly the district court would have the discretion to say your argument was frivolous, therefore you should not receive fees for any of the work that you did. And ultimately, this is a judgment that...
Would it not also be within his discretion here to say that, assuming you lose on the question of retroactivity, would it not also be within his discretion to say you're not the prevailing party for purposes of fee award under those circumstances?
Your Honor, we believe we would continue to be prevailing parties, but whether or not we're entitled to fees is a separate analysis once we get past the one-time threshold that Hensley and INS versus Jan suggest that it's up to the district court to decide.
The district court can never subdivide that prevailing party question as between claims upon which you prevail and claims upon which you don't prevail?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that where the claims are not distinctly different or where the claims are inextricably intertwined, that the prevailing party status is a one-time threshold that the plaintiffs have passed over. And this, for example, in this court's decision in Goose, the court talks about a primary claim and a common nucleus of facts. And what we have here, we submit, is a common nucleus of facts. And it is up to the district court to decide whether or not any fees are appropriate. But here the district court committed an error of law in concluded incorrectly, as we submit, that it did not have the authority or did not have the discretion to award any fees. But if you look at some of the cases, there's for example, that Eighth Circuit case out of Jenkins versus Missouri, the Court of Appeals decided that even though the plaintiffs unsuccessfully opposed a petition for certiorari, that nevertheless the plaintiffs there were entitled to 50% of their fees. And there are cases that we cited in our brief.
Excuse me, Mr. Carr, was that a case involving post-decretal monitoring?
I believe it was, Your Honor. It's
part of all of your cases in which fees are awarded for post-judgment on the merits, the post-judgment expenditures involved monitoring the decree. And there was one in which the fees were denied because there was no need for monitoring the decree, I think a Seventh Circuit case.
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that's right.
Do you have any case in which the fee is not for post-judgment activity that has to be incurred, or fees have to be incurred in order to defend the judgment?
In several cases, I believe this is also true of the Gates case out of the Ninth Circuit. One of the issues in Gates is whether or not it's appropriate to oppose an effort to modify a consent judgment. And so it's not necessarily monitoring, but it arises out of the initial consent judgment. I believe that's the Gautreau case out of the...
Gautreau is a Seventh Circuit case.
Seventh Circuit, yes, Your Honor. If I may, I'd like to reserve. Are there no questions?
Well,
Is
there anything about your argument that would not apply, is there any reason to think that your argument would not apply to every at least Civil Rights Act case, maybe not, it doesn't have to be civil rights, every single claim case?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, it's
you have one claim, you prevail, the attorney's fees litigation, then is your prevailing party now for once and for all.
Well, I think the first of all, it's a class action, and part of our argument is that we were under a duty to litigate the issue. But secondly, it would be up to the district court to determine, in light of Hensley, the extent of success considering the litigation as a whole. And under the looking at the cases, both of us.
I'm interrupting, and I'll certainly give you attention. Isn't that what the district judge did here? He said you prevailed as to the extent of the merits claim, but not as to the extent of the predate interest.
I believe what the district court did is misinterpreted a couple of the cases, but held that the district court did not have the discretion to award any fees whatsoever. And that the district court had, in effect, ruled that the plaintiffs had lost their status as a prevailing party. And we submit that under Hensley, the courts have to look at the overall relief in the context of what it is that the plaintiffs achieved and weigh each portion of the application for fees or each discrete phase of the litigation against that.
All right, so if there's a single claim and you win on your single claim, then, by your lights, any subsequent litigation over attorney's fees, non-frivolous litigation over attorney's fees, is compensable.
No, I'm saying that we're still prevailing parties and that issue is committed to the informed discretion of the district court.
I didn't say it'd be compensated, but it's compensable.
Theoretically, it's compensable if the district court, weighing the Hensley factors, determines that the plaintiffs pass the test, if you like.
What would be a factor that the district court might invoke to deny or give a haircut to the?
Certainly one of the factors that they would consider would be the extent of success.
Well, you had one claim and you prevailed.
Well, it can be extent of success on each subsequent aspect of the litigation. So, for example, going back to the Jenkins case, the fact that the even though the class opposed the petition for certiorari, and even though they were certainly unsuccessful in doing so, nevertheless, 50% of the time that they spent in doing that, whether the Court of Appeals held to be compensable. But that again, normally would be a judgment made by the district court, which starts from the premise that, yes, the plaintiffs continue to be prevailing party, and therefore we will look at each and every thing that you did and weigh the judgment against the context of your still continuing to have that status as a prevailing party.
If
there are no more questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
I think it's 25 seconds. We'll give you back a couple of minutes. You're from the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Daniel Van Horn. I represent the appellees in this matter.
On pages 3 and 4 of the plaintiff's reply brief, they argue that there is a distinction between a statutory waiver of sovereign immunity and the determination of whether a particular application of the statute is retroactive. That is exactly the same argument that the court rejected in Brown versus Secretary of the Army. In the 2001 appeal in this case, in the Trout case, plaintiffs attempted to distinguish Brown on procedural grounds by arguing that the 1991 Civil Rights Act took effect after the judgment in Brown, but that in Trout, the judgment came after the effective date of the 1991 Act. The court rejected that distinction and ruled that the conduct underlying the complaint, rather than the procedural posture of the litigation, is what had the operative significance. Plaintiffs are simply recycling the same arguments they made in the 2001 appeal in this appeal. The only difference is the citation to Austria versus Altman, but that case has nothing to do with the doctrine of federal sovereign immunity. Altman addressed only whether United States courts will grant immunity to foreign sovereigns as a matter of grace and comity under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, however, cannot be characterized as a waiver of sovereign immunity because foreign sovereigns have no right to immunity in United States courts. So there is nothing to waive. And that has been settled law since 1812. Fernandez-Vargas versus Gonzalez makes clear that Altman turned on the peculiarities of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and announced no new legal principles of general applicability when those peculiarities are absent. For that reason, nothing in Austria versus Altman affects this court's decision in the 2001 Trout appeal. It is not an intervening change of controlling legal authority, and the plaintiff's motion to reinstate judgment in their favor in the district court was properly denied. Plaintiffs also argue in their reply brief that they presented arguments to the district court that defendants contend were in fact never presented to the district court. The plaintiffs do not specify exactly where they made those arguments, so before coming to court today, I reviewed every filing that plaintiffs made after the remand from the 2001 Trout appeal. In none of those filings was there any argument that defendants have some sort of contractual obligation to pay plaintiffs' attorneys' fees for the prejudgment interest litigation. Those filings also contain no argument that the prejudgment interest dispute constituted some sort of monitoring or enforcement activity with respect to the 1993 Trout consent decree. The filings contain no argument about refunding expert witness fees, and they contain no argument that defendants' refund request is somehow unfair to the plaintiff's counsel. Now, I can't ask them questions, but when he comes back here up here on rebuttal, I would be grateful if one of you would ask him exactly where he made those arguments before the district court with some page citations, because I would tell you he's not going to be able to provide a satisfactory answer to that question. Third, on page 10 of plaintiff's reply brief, plaintiff asked the court to follow the Eighth Circuit's decision in Jenkins versus Missouri and the cases on which Jenkins relies. I'm glad he said that, because Jenkins actually contains an excellent discussion of the applicability of Hensley versus Eckerhart in a post-judgment setting. The discussion in Jenkins versus Missouri on the Hensley point exactly parallels the arguments that the defendants have made here. Furthermore, the cases that are cited in Jenkins are even better for the defendant. One case is called Association for Retarded Citizens versus Schaefer. It's an Eighth Circuit case. That's also cited in our brief. And in that case, in a post-judgment setting, plaintiffs made what the court characterized as new claims for relief. They were unsuccessful on those claims, and the court ruled that there was no fee for that unsuccessful work. Another case that is cited in Jenkins, and that's very helpful here, is called Willie M. versus Hunt. That's cited at 732 Fed 2nd 383 and is a Fourth Circuit case from 1984. In that case, there was a dispute about the class definition that appeared in the consent decree, and that became a matter of litigation, which the plaintiffs lost. The court ruled that the consent decree, the provision on the definition of the class, and the dispute about that was really more a matter of contractual interpretation that was not really related to the original civil rights claims in the plaintiff's complaint. And therefore, the plaintiffs received no fee for that aspect of the litigation. Now, of course,
were they told that they were not prevailing parties?
Of course they were prevailing parties, but the prevailing party does not.
The district judge exercised discretion to award a fee of zero to that prevailing party.
It's not an exercise of discretion, Your Honor, because once the court decides that the subsequent litigation is unrelated to the claims on which the plaintiffs succeeded, then the judge has no discretion to award a fee. That's consistent. That's what this court said in Anthony versus Sullivan.
Right.
Where the court has discretion is considering whether the claims are related.
Is the relatedness issue part of the initial question of prevailing party on this for this activity, or is it at the back end?
No, Your Honor, no one disputes that the plaintiffs are prevailing parties in this case. That has never been disputed by the defendants. It was never any finding to the contrary by the district court. The question is whether the prejudgment interest litigation constitutes a separate and discrete part of the case.
Let me ask you this. Suppose in a single claim case like this, there is a request for both compensatory and punitive damages, and every penny of compensatory damages is granted, and no punitives, and there's an appeal on the punitives. We have a distinct claim?
Probably not, because there's probably a common core of operative fact there that gives rise to
both. Relief, right? Just a matter about the relief.
Well, Your Honor, let me give you an example in Anthony versus Sullivan. That was a single claim case, too. Now, it's not a class action. It's a single plaintiff case. You can distinguish it on that basis. But it is a single claim case. The single claim was a mandamus action. Anthony prevailed on the mandamus action. Then Anthony got an attorney's fee award that wasn't limited by the Equal Access to Justice Act. Having won that in the district court, the government appeals. Anthony defends the attorney's fee award in the Court of Appeals and loses. Then he goes back to district court and, much like the plaintiffs here, says, I'm a prevailing party on my single claim. I had to defend that claim when I won it in district court on appeal, and therefore, even though I lost, I should get an attorney's fee. This court said no, applied Hensley, and said when there is no success on a particular discrete aspect of the litigation, there is no fee. And the case that is really helpful on this, plaintiff cited a 1995 decision in Goose versus National Realtors Association. But the Goose decision that's really relevant to what we're talking about today is the 1993 Goose decision. That appears at 997 Fed 2nd, 1565. And that's the case which discusses at length when claims are properly deemed related and when they should be deemed distinct. And as demonstrated by that Goose case, claims are distinct when they do not present alternative legal theories for the same relief and do not share a common core of operative fact. Now here, the employment discrimination claims on which the plaintiffs did succeed involved a pattern and practice of sex discrimination that affected certain female civilian employees of the Navy during the 1970s. By contrast, the prejudgment interest issue in the 2001 Trout appeal was a matter of statutory construction involving the doctrine of federal sovereign immunity and principles governing retroactive application of a new statute that created a new compensatory damages remedy. There was no factual or legal overlap between the employment discrimination issue on which the plaintiffs succeeded and the prejudgment interest issue on which the plaintiffs did not succeed.
Well, that'll always be the case.
Pardon?
That'll almost always be the case.
Well, almost always be the case?
Sure.
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Sure. Well, the dispute over the interest, why would that involve elements
You are absolutely right. It is distinct. I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. The claim for prejudgment interest did not involve relief that the plaintiffs were awarded under some alternative legal theory because they didn't succeed on the prejudgment interest claim at all. And the prejudgment interest claim doesn't share a common core of operative fact with the employment discrimination claim because the court did not examine the discriminatory events in the 1970s for purposes of determining whether the 1991 Civil Rights Act was retroactive. So the two things are completely separate, both legally and factually. Furthermore, the prejudgment interest dispute is also procedurally distinct from every other aspect of this litigation. In 1993, the consent decree, in this case, ended the litigation on the merits and settled all the back pay claims. Plaintiff's request for prejudgment interest, therefore, was a new phase of the case that was separate and distinct from the proceedings leading up to the 1993 consent decree. In this new phase of the case, plaintiffs sought to expand their victory by getting prejudgment interest on their back pay and fee awards. That phase of the case, therefore, is properly treated as if it were a new, separate lawsuit for purposes of plaintiffs' entitlement to fees. And the very cases on which plaintiffs rely, Cody versus Hilliard, Filer versus Abbott, and Johnson versus Tulsa, all recognize that principle. District Court did not review abuse its discretion in ruling that the claims were distinct, and once the District Court made that determination, it had no discretion to award any fee for the unsuccessful interest litigation because, as the court said, this court said in Anthony versus Sullivan, when the plaintiff achieves no success on a distinct aspect of the litigation, Hensley says loud and clear that no fee may be awarded.
Well, let me ask you to comment on this. This is the appellant's representation about Anthony. Anthony was not the prevailing party in his Title VII claim, although he prevailed on a non-Title VII mandamus claim. Court held that no fees could be awarded to Anthony for his unsuccessful defense in an appeal of his entitlement to fees under Title VII because he had not prevailed on his Title VII claim at trial and was never a prevailing party under Title VII. Is that accurate?
Not entirely. As I read the Anthony decision, the case that he brought was not a Title VII case. It was a mandamus case. And then the district court awarded fees as if it had been a Title VII case, therefore free from the fee cap under the Equal Access to Justice Act.
And we said, you can't do that.
You said, and then okay. That is appealed. Court says, can't do that.
Right.
Anthony goes back and says, I'm the prevailing party on my single claim. I got a favorable fee award in the district court. I had to defend it in district court, in the Court of Appeals. Therefore, I should get fees for my unsuccessful claim. And the court said, no.
That's the district court said no.
The Court of Appeals said no.
You're back. Okay. So is he in the Court of Appeals a second time?
He goes back to the Court of Appeals and says, "I should have had fees for my unsuccessful."
There's a distinction being drawn in the case between the mandamus and the Title VII, right?
There is a distinction being drawn between the mandamus and one aspect of the relief that he got, which was attorney's fees, not limited by the EJA.
I take it you. Acknowledge that if the case were one of compensatory and punitive damages, that the litigation, unsuccessful litigation, over the punitives would be compensable.
That is, speaking in generalities, that's probably right, because the compensatory damages and the punitive damages would be based on the same core of operative fact.
Presumably there is some element
Right.
that is additionally blameworthy that is necessary for the punitive damages, it's not, not necessary for the compensatory.
It's hard for me to give a...
It would be a common core, but it would not necessarily be the common core.
That may be right.
So I'm not sure that you want to concede that point.
Well, I'm happy to not concede it. It's a little hard to answer in the abstract when I don't know exactly what the facts are, but if...
Well, I'll give you a little bit more to go on, but just taking Judge Santel's observation. Liability involves three elements. Let's say it's a tort case, you know, and a duty and a breach and harm. And the claim is for compensatory damages for that tort, and a claim that it was done with willful negligence, and therefore there should be punitives. And the compensatory is granted. The court says you failed to make a case on willfulness or extreme negligence or gross negligence. Plaintiff appeals on gross negligence and loses.
And we're just limited to that one thing?
That's all it is. One everything else.
Then there's a good argument that is distinct, although this is a matter which is really for the district court judge to review in the district court judge's discretion.
That's exactly Mr. Carroll's position.
No, I don't think so.
That it ought to be for the, in this case, too, it ought to be for the district court.
No, he's making a somewhat different argument, as I see it. He's saying that the district court here made a decision as a matter of law.
Doesn't it?
That no, the judge made a decision on relatedness as to the facts of the case.
Okay.
And then once he decides that the claims are distinct, then he has no discretion to award fees, because distinct claims, you get no fee award.
Well, okay, he's decided that they're distinct, but as to whether they're distinct, whether the claim for attorney's fees and the underlying claim are distinct claims. Listen to this sentence in Helmsley. It may well be that cases involving unrelated claims are unlikely to arise with great frequency. Now, of course, if attorney's fees are unrelated to the underlying claim, then it will arise in every case, not with infrequency.
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
It may well be, the Supreme Court, it may well be that cases involving unrelated claims are unlikely to, it actually says such unrelated claims, are unlikely to arise with great frequency.
What are the such unrelated claims, John?
Two distinctly different claims for relief based on different facts and legal theories. That's what you say we've got here, right?
We have an employment discrimination claim, which is distinct from a prejudgment interest claim.
Yes.
Prejudgment interest claim is a matter of statutory construction.
Whatever the court, whatever we mean by distinct and different claims, the court anticipates that that will be kind of unusual. It'd be like, I sue you for employment discrimination and a Fair Credit Act violation.
Mm-hmm. And
quite unrelated, no common elements at all.
Well. Again, the Goose case found that there were common elements even when there were distinct claims because they involved the same central core of operative
fact. Well, it's possible there could be. I gave you two where it seems extremely unlikely.
It may be unlikely.
And that's what the court's saying. That's going to be pretty unlikely. Okay? But if attorney's fees are ordinarily regarded as a distinct matter, distinct claim from the underlying substantive claim, then it won't be infrequent at all. It will be the norm.
No, attorney's fees are collateral to the cause.
I don't understand you to be arguing that attorney's fees.
No, I'm not. I'm not making that argument.
That prejudgment interest under the
prejudgment interest was what was distinct.
Yes.
And then there's no fee for that work.
Attorney's fees.
No, you're right.
Can still be the same claim, and this can still be distinct.
Of course.
Yes, you're okay. Well, I was sneaking up on it, but now we'll get right to it. So now we're at prejudgment interest.
In prejudgment interest, the district court here found that it did not involve a common core of operative fact. It was not an alternative legal theory for any relief that the plaintiffs got.
So that would always be the case with prejudgment, always with prejudgment interest, would it not?
If you had a prejudgment interest case like this one, but this is a fairly unusual prejudgment interest case.
How could the dispute over prejudgment interest entail any of the elements that were common were also part of the substantive claim?
I would agree that it wouldn't, but you wouldn't normally have this because we have a retroactivity issue that is only going to arise in a very small number of cases that were pending when the 1991 Act was passed.
That is true.
Yep.
That does not make it unimportant.
I'm not saying it's unimportant. You said we're talking about how frequently.
Yeah, not make it distinct.
Well, yeah, the prejudgment interest disputes could arise when there's no issue of retroactivity over the calculation.
That is possible, too, and that would be, I would suggest, a good candidate for a distinct claim if the plaintiffs take a position that's calculated in a way that turns out to be wrong, because the underlying discriminatory conduct doesn't have anything to do with deciding what's the right way to calculate it.
So it doesn't matter whether that's a colorable argument that they're making, but if they've lost, that's
if they've lost, it is a distinct claim for relief. And because it's a distinct claim for relief, there's no fee for lack of success.
The prejudgment interest is a distinct claim for relief.
Prejudgment interest is a distinct claim.
Not the difference in the calculations.
No, no.
Okay.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, then you had 25 seconds left. We give you 2 minutes.
Thank you.
First of all, let me answer one of the questions that was thrown up rhetorically. I'm looking at my notes to reference the Judge Brown's decision in a case called Woodruff versus Peters. And that case, as I read it, says the parties are not limited to the precise arguments that they made below. I think the portions of our pleadings that we quoted, we argue that we continue to be the prevailing parties. And certainly that issue was we would submit adequately preserved for review. Going back to Judge Ginsburg's point about the connection, now what we have here is a finding of discrimination, and based on the same analytical tools, based on the same regression analysis, the court awarded back pay, and what we're claiming or asking for is pre-1991 interest. Now, part of the Navy has already paid part of the prejudgment interest in this case. The Navy paid the prejudgment interest from 1991 to 1993. The question is whether or not, and they it would appear they thought that was related, but the question is, would there be any claim for prejudgment interest in the absence of an award of back pay? And we'd submit that there wouldn't be any such claim. There's no, without a claim or an award of back pay, there's certainly no entitlement or no basis for, the plaintiff's asking for interest. To go back to Judge Ginsburg's question about Anthony, in the first appeal, the court said there were no Title VII fees, but their fees were available under the Equal Access to Justice Act. And as I read the holding in the second Anthony appeal, there's no Equal Access to Justice Act fees for an appeal where the unsuccessfully defended fees that were awarded under Title VII. But in addition to that, as I read this court's opinion, this court said that the government's position was substantially justified and on the appeal, and that was part of the court's reasoning in denying any award of fees. And so we'd submit that the facts presented there are distinctly different from what we have here. We'd ask that the court look at or consider the fact that, for example, on a motion for a contempt hearing, the court held that even though that was separate, it was nevertheless.
The 2 minutes and the 25.
Okay.
So unless my colleagues have further questions, the case will be submitted and we'll take a brief recess.